Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, April 25th, 2017. Once again, Sudan accuses the Kiir administration for supporting Sudanese rebels.
Juba is supporting the rebels to attack Khartoum. When they saw that they have this conflict between them, now they are uniting them so that they can keep on.
And civil society activists say the government must intervene to stop the skyrocketing prices of food items across South Sudan.
We are deeply concerned that majority of our fellow citizens are unable to afford their daily basic needs, such as food items, clean drinking water, and health care. If this situation continues, it may result into more human suffering.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Services are renewing accusations that the Kiir administration is supporting rebels of the SPLM North. Khartoum says it has reliable information that President Salva Kiir, First Vice President Taban Dengai, and other top South Sudanese officials met with SPLM North leaders last week in Juba. President Kiir's spokesperson flatly denied the allegation, calling them baseless. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal echoed Sudanese intelligence accusations that President Kiir met with the Sudanese rebels to try to solve the leadership crisis within SPLM North. Bilal says President Kiir is helping SPLM North rebels overcome recent internal divisions so that the group can stand united against Khartoum.
Always Juba is supporting the rebels to attack Khartoum. When they saw that they have this conflict between them, now they are uniting them so that they can keep on.
Bilal insists that long ago Khartoum stopped harboring South Sudanese rebels who want to topple the regime in Juba, and his government expects Juba should do the same for Sudan.
We are not supporting any rebels here in Khartoum. We are receiving more than 1 million refugees from the south here in Sudan, and we are looking forward for good relations with Juba. But it seems that Juba does not have the same idea.
President Kiir's press secretary, Atenue Kateng, says the president was busy traveling to Kapoita last week, and when he returned, he was focused entirely on internal affairs. He denies the president held any meetings with Sudanese opposition.
They alluded to a non-existing meeting between the president and the so-called the northern opposition. This thing did not happen because on Saturday, that is the weekend they are alluding to, the president did have a meeting with the judges because the judges were actually threatening the strike. And on Sunday, the president doesn't meet anybody. So the president goes to church on Sunday and take rest. So the president came to work yesterday and he did not have a meeting with any opposition group of any country.
Ateng says President Kiir and his government are busy trying to put their house in order and would never think of meddling in Sudan's affairs or try to undermine the regime in Khartoum.
South Sudan is looking to return itself to normalcy. And by returning to normalcy, the first thing for South Sudan to do is to stop engaging neighboring rebels. And this we have seen cease to have or to have any rebel group in South Sudan.
President Kiir's spokesman says such accusations should not sour relations between the two neighboring countries and asserts that South Sudan is committed to strengthening its cooperation with Sudan.
Government of South Sudan is ready continue to cooperate with Khartoum government, not rebels, because our mutual respect is represented by governments, not by rebels.
For years, Sudan and South Sudan have traded accusations of supporting each other's opposition. And each time, government officials from both countries deny the accusations directed at them and often respond with counter-accusations. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The World Bank has pledged $50 million to three United Nations agencies to help combat famine and food insecurity in South Sudan. That's according to a World Bank spokesperson in Ethiopia. The funds will go directly to UNICEF, the World Food Programme, and the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. South Sudan Finance Minister Stephen Dow Diu told Reuters news agency that the African Development Bank has committed $48 million in loans and grants to help rebuild the economy. Dow did not offer further details. South Sudanese civil society organizations say the government needs to restore peace and address the rapidly deteriorating economic situation in the country. More than 10 local civil society organizations say most South Sudanese are unable to feed themselves or their loved ones. Michael Atit has this report for VOA from Juba.
Rajab Mohandis, the executive director for the South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections, read a statement to reporters on behalf of the civil society groups worried about skyrocketing prices.
We are deeply concerned that majority of our fellow citizens throughout the country are unable to afford their daily basic needs, such as food items, clean drinking water, and health care. We, the civil society organizations, believe that if this situation continues, it may result into more human suffering, loss of lives, and increased crime in our country.
The groups say the government should declare severe food shortages across South Sudan as an economic emergency. Mohandis also says the government must also stop hyperinflation by regulating the prices of goods, services, and
regulate and control the circulation of hard currencies such as the dollar, euro, and the sterling pounds in the market. Be transparent and accountable in the management of the meager resources in the country.
The group also calls on the government to immediately remove soldiers, tanks, and armored vehicles patrolling the streets of Juba. Mohandis says the deployment of military to the streets of Juba contradicts the government's claim that it is committed to ending the fighting through peaceful discourse. He also urged the development partners and friends of South Sudan not to abandon the people at this critical time.
Observe, monitor, and support South Sudanese engagement on averting the current political and economic downturn in the country. Humanitarian agencies should increase their support towards the already hunger-affected populations in our country. Constructively engage the government of South Sudan to positively respond to citizens' demands.
Civil society groups say they are lobbying government officials, urging them to organize an all-inclusive stakeholders conference to deliberate on current political and economic situation in South Sudan. The group did not mention when this conference will begin. Late last year, President Kiir announced a national dialogue involving all stakeholders, which he said would take place sometimes in early March. Much has been said about the dialogue, but it has yet to take place. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
South Sudanese refugees at a Gojo camp in Uganda's Adjumani district say after months of hardship, they are finally rebuilding their lives, starting with the construction of semi-permanent structures to house their families. Simon Apiku reports for VOA from Adjumani district in northern Uganda.
Alex Duku ended up at the Agozo camp last November, which at the time was a vast expanse of empty land. Duku says everybody was initially accommodated in large communal tents with poor hygiene and sanitation conditions. That caused diseases to spread, including a cholera outbreak, which Duku says left more than a dozen people dead.
We were gathered together in the center where they have put it us, and it was congested. Many people died due to that circumstance.
The refugees say after crossing into Uganda, they spent 3 weeks at the refugee collection center at the border town of Elegu. Later, they spent 3 months at the nearby Nyimazi transit camp. Modi Lokoya, a refugee at the Agozo camp, says making his way to a refugee camp was not easy. He says families are often forced to spend the night in an open area.
We face a lot of difficulties because at that very day, during our arrival here, we were being washed by the rain simply because of the no place for us to accommodate ourselves.
Julius Diti, another camp resident, says within a few days, the refugees had erected makeshift structures from the plastic sheeting and other materials provided to them. He says refugees used the little money they fled with from South Sudan to construct grass-thatched mud houses.
There we have been working in our country, so we come with a little budget which we have from there, which will at least make us to start.
Plans to immediately transfer some of the refugees to the Bidibidi settlement in Yumbe district ran into problems after some refugees refused to leave, citing unfavorable conditions in Yumbe. Eventually, most of the refugees were forcibly moved to Bidibidi. Lokoya says once he was resettled, he tried to gather grass for his hut, but that turned out to be problematic as residents of the host community rounded up refugee women cutting the grass. He says their hosts allowed the women to continue only after authorities intervened.
We have built our same permanent chokehold, so we get a grass from this host community. But during our times of getting the grass, the host community, they have arrested our housewives not to cut the grasses.
Diji says their efforts were also hampered by bad weather conditions, which further delayed construction of the houses.
We take something of almost 2 months because rain has been disturbing us too much. So we really suffer like when we're starting from Elegu up to Nyimadzi and then here.
Diti managed to build 3 houses on his compound, including 2 constructed out of mud bricks and covered with iron sheets. The girls sleep in one house and the boys in another. There is also a small structure their family uses as a kitchen, a shelter for bathing, and a latrine. But Lokoya, whose family comprises 11 adults and 6 children, says the 900 square meters of land allotted to each family is too small for those with large families like him.
Because all other things like latrine, shelters, and rubbish picking, as the population grows, so you need to construct a lot of houses.
Despite limited space, Diti and Lokoya say they feel they are reasonably settled. That is not the case for Jackson Alira, who has yet to be recognized as a refugee. Alira says the UNHCR turned down his request for asylum since he cannot prove he is South Sudanese.
The UNHCR told me I have to register and then I have to present a document which can show I'm South Sudanese. So when I'm coming from there, I was not here in the war when I wasn't at home. So I did not collect even my document and then the judge came like that, so there's nothing I can present for the UNHCR to show that I'm close to this.
As a result, Alira says he has no plot of land to live on, nor does he receive monthly food rations or free medical care that refugees receive. But he says he has bigger problems than that.
Even up now, I did not find the rest of my family. So I got only 2 children of mine, they are my brothers, and then we have been staying with them up now.
Refugee leaders say as they settled into their new homes, they worry about the youth who have no job opportunities or at risk of being lured into deviant behavior, possibly even criminal activity. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku in Adjumani District, Northern Uganda.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what is being done to combat malaria in South Sudan? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What worries you the most about the future?
Most it's, will I find a job? Will I be able to achieve things within the 5 years? How is my financial status will be? Will I be stable? Will the country be stable to give me a chance also?
I'm bothered about my country because since when that war began, now my education is not, I'm not settled at all. This year I've not entered school just because my parents who support me, they lack money now, they are in the bush. They no longer work.
There are so many things that worries me, especially about the future. People are saying that we are still a young country. But I can say we are not new because we have experience from different countries. But still, our country is still in a backward, for instance, education.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Speaking at a UN Security Council meeting in New York today, the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General and the head of the UN mission in South Sudan, David Sierra, says the council has been on. There has been no concerted effort by any party in South Sudan to adhere to a ceasefire.
In addition to these more retaliatory operations, there are significant military operations linked to gaining tactical advantage over opposition positions before the onset of the rainy season.
David Sayre says instead over the past months, what they are seeing is an increase of the conflict, forcing the United Nations mission to increase its protection activities to deter violence and monitoring reporting human rights violations. Sarah urged the council members to look for opportunities that will finally end hostilities in the country.
Despite what appears to be attempts by the parties to achieve victory by military means, a political solution is the only way forward for South Sudan. Military offensives are fracturing groups and intensifying ethnic divisions to a degree which will hinder reconciliation. Regrettably, no party has shown interest in reviving the peace agreement.
The top UN diplomat says he believes there is a political solution to the country's conflict.
Let me underscore that the political process in South Sudan is not dead. However, it requires significant resuscitation. UNMISS will to work together with our partners on opportunities to forge viable solutions to bring an end to the hostilities and the suffering of the people of South Sudan.
That was David Sierra, the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General to South Sudan, addressing the UN Security Council this past hour in New York. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about malaria because it's World Malaria Day. World Malaria Day is dedicated to shining a spotlight on the global effort to control the spread of malaria. The day celebrates the successes that have been achieved, but it's also meant to raise awareness of the disease. In Juba, the rising cost of living makes the treatment and prevention of malaria much more difficult than it has been in the past. Mungomedev's Rakarinj visited one Juba neighborhood to learn what some residents do to prevent the spread of the disease.
The winds blow in Juba's Gudel neighborhood, raising the dust as it starts rain, forcing 18-year-old Emanuela Akujo to take her newborn baby inside her house. Speaking in Juba Arabic, Akujo says she has been sick for 2 days.
I have been vomiting yellowish fruit. I am weak and my body has been shivering from time to time.
Others have reported those types of symptoms when they are diagnosed with malaria. A sick person usually has a fever, sweats, chills, mouth itches, and a headache. The sickness may also result in breathing problems and, if not treated, liver failure and can eventually lead to death. It's caused by a parasite called Plasmodium, which is transmitted by female mosquitoes known as Anopheles. Akujo worries her 2 months baby may also contract malaria. In 2015, there were 212 million new cases of malaria and 429,000 deaths. One child dies from malaria every 2 minutes, according to the 2016 World Malaria Report. Young children and pregnant women are the most vulnerable, but often cannot access life-saving prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. Akujo's father, Isaac Aripa, who is the Deputy Director of Records Management for the National Ministry of Physical Infrastructure, says at any given time, one of his family members is typically diagnosed with malaria and other family members are likely to catch the disease. And he says receiving treatment is not easy.
All prices have gone up. That's why for myself I use traditional medicine because the prices in the NAD are skyrocketing. I mean, to see a doctor. And then it's prescribed medicine, you go to the pharmacy, to the private clinic. Usually you go to the private clinics. That is where we shall get another proper treatment. Mm. I spend maybe say half of the salary for medicines.
Gudele resident, 24-year-old Rosemary Ajiba says she used to catch malaria almost twice a month. Ajiba, who works for an NGO, says she too would spend nearly half her salary on malaria treatment.
Oh, sorry about that.
It's fallen.
It's fallen, but normally I hang it up, and when I put it like this, I spread it all over the bed. Mm. Okay, I spread it normally, sorry that it's down, but I hang it up and spread it all over the bed. I first leave it a bit for, you know, this hotness of Juba. I go out, also put this repellent on my body. I cover, I smear on my body to, as in, take away the mosquitoes from me.
Ajiba is talking about her mosquito net, which she says has helped her save money.
I normally stay like even months without catching malaria. Yeah, just because of how I prevent it anyway.
According to the World Health Organization, sub-Saharan Africa showed us 90% of the global malaria burden. The health agency says about 43% of people in sub-Saharan Africa who are at risk of malaria were not protected by either a net or indoor insecticides spraying in 2015. WHO advises the use of treated mosquito nets and spraying pesticides to kill mosquito-transmitting insects in and around houses. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Arua, Northern Uganda.
The World Health Organization says the rate of malaria infection among children and women in South Sudan is high due to lack of logistical support to combat the disease. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
WHO medical officer in Juba, Dr. Lincoln Cherimari, says the nature of South Sudan environment is perfectly suited to the disease-transmitting mosquito.
You need the vector that transmits the disease. That vector is present in all parts of South Sudan. That vector needs certain conditions for it to breed and multiply. And these conditions include rainfall, include high temperatures, include high humidity. And these are present in all parts of South Sudan to different extents, as described by the risks I talked about in the different parts of the country.
Dr. Cherimari says the number of people infected with the disease in South Sudan has been on the rise over the last 5 years due to insecurity and other poverty-related factors.
If you look at 2012, for example, through to 2016, in 2012 you had about a little over 700,000 cases of malaria in people aged 5 years and over, and that number rose to a little over 1.1 million in 2016. And in children under five in 2012, it was around 400,000-500,000, and in 2016 that figure had gone up to about 600,000 people.
WHO is collaborating with a number of partners to control malaria by distributing insecticide-treated nets and indoor sprays to refugee populations and IDP camps. Cherimari says WHO and South Sudan health officials are also providing services at various primary health care centers throughout the country. But even with that, he says, access to treatment is limited across South Sudan.
The challenges that the malaria control community in South Sudan face include logistical challenges of delivering services, especially preventive interventions, occasioned by the long rainy season that South Sudan has, and occasioned by flooding in some parts of the country, where then physical access becomes difficult. Other challenges, of course, include some health facilities that are not functioning at optimal levels because they now have fewer health workers.
WHO and various partners have come up with mobile teams to try to reach people in remote areas. Cherimari says certain sectors of communities are at higher risk of dying from the disease.
The whole population is at risk, but within that we've got groups that are at higher risk than others. Pregnant women are at higher risk, children under five are at higher risk. People that may be displaced and services are not easily accessible are also at higher risk.
The period of a malaria incubation is estimated to be between 6 to 12 hours, marked by shivering, fever, headaches, sweating and fatigue. If you or someone you know is having these symptoms, medical attention should be sought immediately. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Still on malaria, three African countries are set to use the world's first malaria vaccine beginning next year. A senior technical officer for WHO malaria vaccine tells VOA's Kim Lewis the injectable vaccine was developed to protect young children.
WHO is really pleased today, World Malaria Day, during Africa Vaccination Week, to be able to announce these three countries that are going to be piloting the world's first malaria vaccine. And these three countries are Malawi, Kenya, and Ghana.
How will this vaccine work?
This vaccine is designed for African children specifically to prevent illness and death in those children. It works by preventing malaria symptoms before they start, but I should be clear that it isn't a perfect vaccine. So kids will still get malaria, but they'll get far less malaria and less severe malaria.
What age ranges will participate in the program?
The childhood vaccination programs in each of the countries will be rolling out this vaccine, and they'll be initiating the vaccine for these children at about 5 to 6 months of age. This vaccine is a little bit unique in that it requires 4 doses, and the last dose is given at 2 years of age. Most childhood vaccinations are finished by 2 years of age.
And also, despite all of the global efforts that have been taking place to reduce malaria deaths, hundreds of thousands of people still die from malaria. So what is the goal of this vaccine in terms of actually preventing deaths?
This is exactly right. There have been tremendous gains in malaria control. Even the last 5 years across Africa, malaria deaths have been reduced by 30%. But nonetheless, there are still 200 million cases of malaria and 400,000 deaths every year, and most of those are in young African children. If this vaccine works the way we expect, and if we're able to reach children with these 4 doses, tens of thousands of children's lives could be saved every year.
How long will it take before you all know that the vaccine is effective?
Well, we know that the vaccine is effective, that those trials are finished. We know that this vaccine will reduce malaria cases. We know that it will reduce severe malaria. What we need to find out through these programs is, are we able to get to the children? Are we able to reach them with these vaccine doses that are outside the usual vaccine schedule? So parents will have to come to the clinic to get the vaccine a little later than they usually do in the first year of life, and then around 2 years of age.
So overall, then, what do you think this really means in terms of reducing the deaths from malaria?
I think that if WHO recommends this vaccine for broader use, depending on the results of this pilot implementation program, this vaccine could really be an important addition to the tools that we already have, saving in addition tens of thousands of children's lives every year.
That's Dr. Mary Hamel, a senior technical officer for the WHO's malaria vaccine implementation program in Africa. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Nairobi. At least there is good news that there is a vaccine for malaria. That brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We'll leave you with the song Ashao by a traditional Zande group in Yambio. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you again tomorrow, the same time here, for more on VOA.
your asha.